Wednesday, November 21st, 1990, Riaz and I, Berlin, and Political Philosophy.
Bernard, for biographical purposes, I simply wanted to get an account, a narrative from you of when you first met Isaiah, how your lives have entwined over the last number of years. You can start wherever you want. But if we could be as systematic as we can.
Yeah, I can start right at the beginning, actually. He is, of course, as you know, he's 20 years... Sorry. In fact, exactly 20 years older than I am. And he's always, there's always been a time gap thing about that. He was the same age as Freddie Eyre was, and these people who I both count as my friends were 20 years older than myself, and another close friend, Stuart Hampshire, is 15 years older than myself, so I'm in the slightly odd position of having some close friends who are that much older than myself. And because of that, I actually first met him as when I was a student. In fact, I think I'm right in saying that the very first words that we ever exchanged was after a lecture, an undergraduate lecture he gave in Oxford. I suppose it was the usual sort of pushy undergraduate stuff, because it was one of those simply enormous lectures in the schools in Oxford where the lecture is given in a place rather like the Garde d'Orsay, really. And masses of people there, just a regular undergraduate lecture. And he said something that I thought... It was rather typical, actually. He was propounding the then very popular thesis that... what was called something like the polarity argument or something like that, which was a sort of positivist argument that it made no sense to apply a given predicate to everything. So that if you said everything was F, they always answer, what's that supposed to contrast with? And so on. So he was producing this usual sort of argument at the time. And
what time is this?
Well, this must have been in 1949 or 50. And I went up to him afterwards. He'd referred to Thales possibly having said that everything was made of water. So I went up to him and said again, a sort of thing you said at that time, that I thought it was meant to be an empirical proposition. That is, if you took absolutely anything and did something to it, it would turn into what you'd recognise as water. And to my surprise, he said, certainly, certainly, it might well be so. So I produced what I thought was an objection, and it's fine, it was accepted by the speaker, as it were. Well, after that, we met from time to time, and I particularly, of course, tended to meet him at musical or operatic occasions of both kinds, interests we've always shared. I didn't know him, I suppose, enormously. Well, then I did get to know him a bit more when I was at All Souls, which was from 1951 to 1954, and then from 54 to 59 I was a fellow of New College, and I saw a little bit of him then.
This is a question of ignorance. What role, if any, did he play in your election at All Souls?
Well, you'd have to check that with others. I can't actually, at this instant, remember. He was at New. He must have been at All Souls at that time. Then he certainly played some role in it, but obviously I don't know what it was. I mean, the person who'd be able to tell you about that, if you would, but I mean, I know if you want to talk to him, otherwise, would be Dummett, who was newly elected at All Souls at that time and certainly was keen on my election. I can't remember if I ever knew what role Isaiah played in that.
But you had no sense of being a protege?
No,
or
absolutely not at all. Not at all. No, I've never had that relationship to him at all. The relationship we've always had has been that of older friend. And, yes, older friend, and in a way, more, I was, as it were, put in the role of, or not put in the role of, but was happy to have the role of, as you might quite say, more professional philosophical colleague or friend, because since he's always had this thing, as you well know, of saying he isn't really a philosopher, or stopped being a philosopher, and that of course goes into the question about the introduction to the book and all that, and he tells the story, in which you must have heard in at least three different versions, about whatever it was that Scheffler said to him that made him stop being Scheffer or whoever it was, stopped him being a philosopher. I had the role of his being the historian of ideas and me being the philosopher. And he's always, our relations have always been predicated on his belief that at philosophy I'm better than he is. And my belief that there are a very large number of things he knows and quite a number of things he understands better than I do. That may be coming from elsewhere. Sorry. Well, no.
I want to keep you to the narrative. Mm. You then talked about going to New College.
Yes.
Is that right, 54 to 59?
Yes. And I think what had happened was that there had been various exchanges because he must have already been at All Souls because Stuart was at New College. And I first met Stuart when I suppose when I just stopped being an undergraduate or when I was just at All Souls or something, in about 1950, 51. And Stuart, I remember seeing him in New College. Now, Stuart took Isaiah's place. They swapped over. Then, of course, Stuart went to New College at a later point, and Tony Quinton came from... went to All Souls from New College, and Tony Quinton came from All Souls. It's exchange went on. So Isaiah must have already gone. Yes, that's right.
Just rolling back before that, the musical connection. How did that occur? That is, did you actually go to concerts together? Did you meet there? I mean,
more the latter. Infrequently, once or twice, I think we went together. I remember occasion which was actually later. It was in the 60s. You will remember, I've even referred to this somewhere, you remember that he wrote this article called The Naive and Sentimental Verdi, or whatever it's called. I mean, it's about, what's the exact title? You know the piece I mean?
Yes, I do.
About, in which he contrasts naive and sentimental artists in the terms that Schiller used, and he particularly addresses itself. It's called The Naivety of Verdi, that's right. And he has characteristically long lists of artists who figure as respectively naive and sentimental in Schiller's terms. And Verdi is a striking example of the naive artist. The interesting fact is that that contrast is formed about Verdi almost entirely, of course, around the fact that there is a corresponding sentimental artist in Schiller's terms, namely Wagner, but he's hardly mentioned at all. He's the silent contrast. I mean, he is mentioned just, but he's almost entirely mentioned by implication. I mean, he describes Verdi as having absolutely straightforward human passions, not issuing manifestos, not being reflective about his art, not going on about things other than opera and all that kind of thing. And of course, the negative pole of that thing is all the time Wagner. And actually, we might come back to that, because I think that notion of the elemental, basic, universal human passions, love of country, love of one's relatives and so on, is very important also for understanding his so-called relativism or whatever about history and politics. But I remember that in the 60s, I think it was 65, 66, I think, I went to a concert performance of The Force of Destiny that was given, no doubt, by the Chelsea Opera Group in Oxford Town Hall, and I've written this down somewhere. Isaiah, in the interval, Isaiah came advancing towards me up the aisle through a crowd of persons, and he sort of wove through people trying to talk to him, sort of heading straight for me. He could see me, and he's coming towards me, sort of straight through the thing. And without any further introduction, he said, you know, of course, Schiller's essay, Über Naiven und Sentimentalische Poesie. So I had to say, I'm afraid I didn't. Oh, disgraceful, disgraceful that you didn't. Shameful, shameful, ignorance. So he then proceeded to lay out the entire thesis of the naivete of Verdi in the middle of Oxford Town Hall, in the entr'acte, yes, that's right. But need to say, it was absolutely stunning, brilliant performance. That was a very characteristic, too. Now, the reason I saw rather less of him in those days, I think, that is, I did see him in the 50s and 60s, as I've described, I mean, sort of on and off, if you know what I mean. But I wouldn't have said at that time that there was any sense in which I was particularly intimate with him. I mean, he was a perfectly good friend of, we were perfectly good friends, was that It's quite an, what has subsequently become a very important element in my life since very early 1970s, is going virtually every year to Portofino, their house in Italy, for a week, or perhaps up to a day or so, less than a week, or possibly even 10 days on certain occasions, in the summer. And that particularly happened when my present family was born, and we took the babies and the young boys there. And actually both my children call Arlene Berlin Granny. She's their only honorary granny, as it were. And to be absolutely frank, the reason, I think one of the reasons that I didn't go to Portofino until the very early 1970s was that neither Isaiah or Arlene liked my first wife. I don't think they ever got on with Shelley. I think they regarded her as sort of far too busy, sort of clattering person, really, and not their taste, really. Whereas they've always adored Patricia, and we've always got on very well. And since then, of course, I think it's particularly since, well, it certainly is, particularly since my marriage to Patricia, that we've, as it were, our relations in that sense have prospered partly through this summer acquaintance. However, there was an incident, one of two incidents in which I've spoken, one or two or three incidents, I suppose, in which I've spoken to Isaiah most closely on a personal matter, was actually before that. And it was in 19... It illustrates the point about which is where I valued his judgment. This was in 1966. Possibly 7. Either 66 or 7. The situation was that I, to my absolutely genuine and considerable surprise, I received a letter from the Vice-Chancellor of Cambridge offering me the Knightbridge Professorship in Cambridge, and which I hope I can say, needless to say, hadn't applied. I'd only been, at this point, Oh, that's right, I'd only been 18 months at Bedford, so it must have been in 1966, something like that. And I was surprised to receive this and very excited by it. And the trouble was, there were various reasons which hung over my accepting it. One was Shirley was working in London, how would a divided life work, and so on. Had some reasons for thinking that possibly marriage wasn't 100% in the best of health anyway, and so on. Secondly, I knew something I shouldn't have known, which was that they'd already made a decision that if I refused it, it would be offered to Stuart. And I had reason to think that Stuart would like that. I think he was at this point in America, and I think that he would have liked to come back to that chair. And I was put in what's called an embarrassing position. In fact, it was I think it was Isaiah that told me it had been offered to Stuart. This having been leaked to him by Herbert Hart, who's one of the electors. I think that was the situation. And I actually thought, and I didn't hold this against Isaiah, I thought it was a rather wicked situation to be put in, really. And I held it against the electors. I didn't think electors ought to do this trick. Mm. I think it's unfair, really, because it always gets out. And so that's it. Now, so I was very in a rather state about this. I'm probably more of a state about it than I would be now, having been a younger person and so on. I went and saw Isaiah, and I actually went to Headington's. I mean, I just especially went and spent the afternoon talking to him about it. And he was a great help. I didn't actually follow his advice, and I think he didn't give me advice that he expected me quite to follow. I think he gave me advice which he might have expected to produce the sort of result it did, in a way. That is, he said that both Stuart and I were behaving absurdly, really. I mean, that what everybody was doing was engaging in sort of Don Carlos-like heroics. And says, you're behaving like Marcus de Posa, he said. Sort of nobility of friendship is being expressed on all sides, and the whole thing can only generate total misunderstanding. You must do what you want to do. And don't try and sort of square it all somehow. Perfectly good advice, actually. I knew I didn't quite do that. I was too squeamish, so I did a very weak thing. That is, I wrote to Stuart. I wrote to Stuart in a coded manner. That is, I wrote to Stuart and said, look, I really do have terrible problems about this decision, quite apart from anything about you. It's not about you. I have terrible decisions because of Shirley and should I London and so on. Because it's so undecided, it would really make a difference to me to know whether you'd accept it if I turned it down. Which is the best I could do at coding. And I said, because I thought I had reason to think the third party would be what both of us would regard as a disaster, and it would be absurd if through a misunderstanding. You can see what I said. And needless to say, I got a sort of immediate heroic letter from Stuart saying, on no account would he accept. He's obviously been briefed by us. saying there was no way in which he would accept it anyway.
Yes.
I didn't think that was true. So everybody did behave in somewhat Don Carlos-like manner, and as I regarded the whole thing as mildly absurd, I think. But that was one of the occasions on which I had, as it were, a close discussion with him. And he was a little, I mean, not in any substantive way, as it were, but he sort of knew what was going on at the time my first marriage broke up and I got to go. Because he'd actually met Patricia, not actually, by accidentally. He'd met her at a dinner at Wolfson College or somewhere. And I think they got on rather well. And then when he discovered what was sort of in the wind, he was rather pleased about that, actually, on general grounds, as it were. So that was one of the matters about which we were quite closely involved. Yes. And then especially after we got together, I mean, from about 1972 or 3 onwards, there have only been 3 or 4 years between then and now in which we've not been there in the summer and so on.
You said earlier that you described one incident in which you went for him to improvise, and that's the nice British chair. Are there other specific incidents which you can remember besides
where I went to him for advice? Yes, about intimate matters.
Yes.
Yes, there was another one. Actually, it always seems to be about professorships. It's not quite professorships. This is very recent. He actually told me off. He reproached me, which is not something he very often does, but he did reproach me. He reproached me because I had told somebody else, Mrs. Brendel, in fact, I told her rather a lot about my feelings about coming back from America to England, which, as you know, has been a very muddled and painful business. And the relevant part is that I accepted the job here when we were, for a whole lot of reasons, in rather low water in California. It had to be done on a kind of bet about whether things were going to get better there or not. And we took what we then thought was the kind of safer option of returning. And then, of course, in the long interval between that and actually coming, things in California got a lot better. And so the last year was spent with a very great deal of regret. I mean, I think actually on the whole we've now put that mostly behind us. I mean, one just goes on, as it were. But it had been a very painful event, series of events, or period, really. The whole thing had been rather horrible. And I actually didn't have many people to talk to about it, except Patricia and one or two friends in Berkeley. But, of course, the friends in Berkeley, whom I had talked to it about, it had a rather sort of odd aspect, because they said, all right, and Donald Davidson actually said to me, well, you must be mad. You said, if that's what you feel, you've got to simply tell them you're not going. Institutions can get over these things. And somehow I found that extremely difficult, in the end, impossible thing to do. I couldn't do it somehow, partly because I thought that it did make such a fuss about my going abroad. It was a kind of double insult, and it somehow meant I'd not only left England, I'd somehow denounced it in some disgraceful way. And I could, anyway, this is a discussion about Isaiah, not about me, but I mean, I had problems about that. And I didn't have many friends. I'm not a person who has very intimate friends, actually, on the whole. I mean, the greatest part, by far the largest part of the interest of my life is actually in my marriage, not rather than with friends. So we are a sort of rather private couple, as it were, rather than by having a lot of... But I mean, I do have, obviously, Stuart and Isaiah among them, as it goes back to thinking about them being older than me, actually, in some way, which is obviously of some importance. And Isaiah reproached me for having said this to Rainey. He said, it's too ungracious, he said. It sounds so bad. Puts you in a bad position. Makes you sound ungrateful, graceless, and arrogant. And it's not a good idea, he said. He said this to me as he left our house in Oxford, just as he came out of the door. I was just getting into the car. sort of left me with this, very untypically actually. Extremely odd, because he's always very careful not, on the whole, to say things that upset one. Certainly not to leave one with something that upsets one. At the time, I felt a little that it was... I mean, you know, as we all know, he's not as young as he was, and it was late in the evening, you know, and he's tired, and he sort of ran away with him, and he didn't mean to say that. I'm not so sure now. Like often with him, I think there was probably more aim in it than I thought at the moment. Anyway, I was very upset by this. I went to see him again. I mean, I went up there and we spent an afternoon talking. And I simply wanted to explain to him how this had come about. And I said, I don't have many friends. I'm not fond of Rainey, and we were there in her hands on, and she's a very good one, as you know. Well, you know, she's a very good one of eliciting, you know. And of course, if you've got any sense, you know, like all people encourage you to gossip to them about oneself, that it's a very good way of a lot of other people getting to know about it. I mean, Patrick Gardner, who's a sort of professional, used to be a kind of professional confidant, he was the man everybody told their secrets to. Yes. He must have received more people's secrets in his time than anybody else. And as Richard Volheim once said, who partly because everybody knew they'd be passed on. Which is slightly true about Rainey, but actually I didn't intend it to be passed on. I just talked because she sort of seduced me into talking about it, if you know what I mean, which is obviously rather good. Anyway, I was told off by Azar, so I went and explained it to him, and the interesting thing was, it's a very interesting fact, I thought a lot about what he said, because he didn't actually, as it were, retract what he'd said. When I told him that I just had a very nasty time, he said, yes, I'm sure it was horrible, must have been a horrible time. And he said, I'm sorry if I didn't mean to be unpleasant, it's awful, I shouldn't be around telling you what I think, it's a terrible thing to do, tell you what to feel. But I was just concerned about the fact that you are, and now this is relevant to him, as it were. He said, the thing you've got to remember is that you have been enormously successful, as have I, though not in exactly the same way. And anybody, or almost anybody, he said, certainly the persons in our position, like you and me, we have something in common. That is to say that there are persons who say we haven't deserved it, who will say that we are, both of us, quite unnecessarily lucky. And if you appear to people to be unnecessarily lucky, you necessarily attract resentment. And persons say, certainly not worth it, why should he be so doing so well? It's not as good as all that. He said, everybody admires your work. But he said, I hear a person saying, you know, it's very, very good, but it's not as good as all that. And he said, of course, he said, your work's much better than mine, he said. I mean, what people say about me is, I'm terribly successful, but he's never done anything. Never anything at all, he said, just all those essays, short books, what has he possibly done? Never done anything. So then this fate, of course, as we all know, this terrible strain of self-doubt, the feeling that his reputation is an artifact, that it's invented, that it's blown up, doesn't really exist. This all came out. I mean, he's spoken in those terms before, never so directly, and it's interesting that he should have spoken directly in relation to what he saw as a problem for me, and in the way of a warning.
But did you see that parallel? Just for the sake of argument?
No. I didn't. I mean, that is to say, I saw its component parts. That is, there's a fact about him I've known, because we all know, I mean, it's a very manifest fact about him, that he has this terrible self-doubt. I mean, you must have already heard about in endless forms, and the tremendous revisions and unwillingness to publish, and the absurd, well, we might come back to that, the absurd, in my view, role in his life of certain powerful, whether they be sort of intellectual, academic, social figures like Bauer, or still more philosophical figures like Austin. I think the reason he stopped being a philosopher isn't anything he's had with that famous conversation with Chaperon, was Austin, really. He was, like a lot of people, unduly terrorized by Austin. And I think, like a lot of people who knew Austin, I think that he'd internalized an Austinian superego about precision, which has killed more philosophical talents in this university. You can you've had hot dinners. I mean, by the moment you'd got that, you'd got into your head that terrible voice just saying, but it just isn't true. It doesn't follow. Now, what's that supposed to mean? Once that voice was ringing in your head, the pen fell flaccidly from your hand and nothing was created. And I think there's an element of that. There are many other elements that you'll know about, understand better than I, but there's an element of that in Isaiah. So I knew that he had all that. Now, I can explain why
and
I didn't...
Parenthetically, it would then follow that the Austinian superego was not in you.
Yes, that's right, that's right. Because I resisted it, I always resisted it. I knew in some instinct... I mean, we ought to be talking about Isaiah, not about me, but I mean... There is a parallel in a way, it's interesting issue because it's come up at this point, which I haven't quite thought about in these days, that by some instinct, I think, I resisted Austin. I didn't know him personally, hardly at all. I didn't like his public philosophical persona. And I think, I even thought at the time, actually, it's one thing I thought self-consciously at the time, because you've got to remember that Austin died in 1960. When I was 31, so it was only a decade of my professional life at all in which I coexisted with Austin, as it were. And
as for Isaiah, it was 30 years.
Absolutely, and his youth and everything. And I didn't go to the Saturday mornings, and I had a reason for that. I probably would have gone if I lived in Oxford, but I lived in London, and I went. Actually, the one term I could have gone because I was living in Oxford, I didn't. Well, that's it. It was toward the end. Now, the reason was that I thought that, much as I admired Austin, I thought that the sort of thing way he went on wasn't the sort of thing I needed. I mean, I'd been persuaded, oddly enough, by a figure whom I now don't have very great philosophical respect, namely Miss Anscombe, because of her Wittgensteinian influence, that philosophy was a serious business which just being clever at it wasn't good enough. And that's one thing I owe Miss Anscombe, actually. She persuaded me in some way of that. That it was, whatever you want to, I mean, it had something to do with things, it wasn't just about being smart. Now, the fact I knew I could be clever wasn't a particular problem I had. And I knew I could be clever in philosophy. And it seemed to me, and I could also be quite harsh and all that stuff, and that's what Austin seemed to me to be. And the sneering dismissal of anything that sounded at all kind of pretentious or imaginative or high-flown just seemed to me exactly the opposite of what both I and actually the subject needed. I always used to say about Austin that he was like somebody in the British Treasury who... he always used to say, you see, that why we needed all this close analysis and so on was to get down the inflated metaphysical philosophical pretensions, you see. And I said that anyone who thought that the British philosophical economy needed deflating was like somebody in the Treasury, you know, who deflates the economy when they're all lining up in the dole queue. The idea that the real trouble with English philosophy was that sort of raving Heideggerian passions were roaring across it. I mean, it's so obviously untrue that, of course, that, like most of other of Austin's explanations of why he went on as he did, was actually a piece of an ideology. It wasn't about why he behaved like that. He went on like that because that was what he was good at doing.
Yes.
And then he had to invent a way in which it was relevant to philosophy. And all the ways he tried to explain it was relevant to philosophy are ridiculous. I mean, they're not even plausible. They were all excuses about it. Anyway, that's by the way, let's go back to the other thing. The thing was that I had, of course, understood about Isaiah's forms of self-doubt. Needless to say, not being a insanely conceited. You know Isaiah's distinction between being conceited and being vain, have you? We'll come back to that, yes. Not being insanely conceited. I'm subject to the thought that A, that I haven't done as much as I might have done, B, that what I've done isn't as good as I or other people or something think it is. I mean, if one isn't very conceited, well, of course one's open to those thoughts. And manifested to some degree, they are, in my case, justified. But they're in such a different territory from Isaiah's, because if it's the case, as I think, that I've done less as yet than I might have done, it's not for Isaiah's like reasons, as it seems to me.
And what are Isaiah like reasons?
I mean, when I say for reasons, I don't mean for Isaiah like causes. I mean that the description of what it was to have done less than one might have done in the two cases is different. That is, that there's some large work of intellectual history. That is, Isaiah has a large number of materials which he simply, as it were, failed to bring together. And so it's got, and obviously the remark that Oscar Wilde made about himself, that he put his genius into his life and only his talent into his work, is one that could be naturally applied to him. But that couldn't be applied to me. I mean, what's the, if that accusation applies to me, is that I've... You know, the work's too clever and hasn't penetrated things as fast as it might have done, or something of that kind. So the basis is different. So because the basis is different, I hadn't, as it were, thought of putting them together.
Yeah. So in a sense, what he said to you by way of explanation of his rebuke did not convince, it did not carry with you, because you felt the two cases, him and you, were
different. No, it didn't. It stood as a rebuke. It's just you were asking why I hadn't made the association he had.
Yes.
And I tried to explain that. But there is a further element to meant it stood as a rebuke, because, of course, I'm not being mad. I'm perfectly aware of the fact that somebody in my position is open to resentment or envy, however you wish to characterise the reasons for that. And the, obviously my problem is like, which is, I think, different from, actually is slightly different from his in terms of people's sentiments, is that I'm likely to look very arrogant. And that, the rebuke stood in relation to that.
And that, yes.
I looked as if I was toying, you know, the University of Oxford and so on. Well, I am rather, that's certainly true. I'm not, as an evidence of that, I can say that I'm not absolutely sure that the University of Oxford in its present condition should necessarily have to be too sensitive about my or other people's arrogance. The difference between being vain and conceited, which Isaiah uses quite a lot. He's rather keen on it, particularly at the moment, actually. And in his usual way, he categorises people in this way. It's perfectly fine to sound. Being conceited means having a false impression of your own merits. Being vain is being very sensitive to what people think about your merits. They're clearly two different things. But as Isaiah points out, they're certainly compatible. He said Freddie was both vain and conceited.
When you've gone to him to talk about something intimate, something painful, something difficult,
yeah.
Whether you can think of any other occasions where you've had these moments when you've had a kind of heart-to-heart.
Yes, well, there was at least one conversation about Patricia leaving her husband and Quentin and all that. I would be quite willing to be upfront, you know, between ourselves, if it had anything of, you know, immensely particular note, but... I mean, he was extremely what you'd expect him to be. I mean, he was very... I mean, after he had a certain experience not unrelated to... not totally unlike that himself. And he was quite funny about that in the way... I don't know whether he must have talked to you at various points about Dr. Halban. And he's quite funny about Dr. Halban, I must say. He did... One of the ways in which it seemed to me that it helped me a lot was, of course... And this is often true about, as we all know, platitude about the best sorts of friends and best sort of advice, was not, of course, anything he told one to do, or even anything he told one to think about what one had done. By the way in which he described his own experience and a certain sensibility he brought to that, it was frightfully good at cheering one up. I mean, while acknowledging... perfectly frankly, what could scarcely be denied, namely that I behaved extremely badly towards Quentin Skinner, which is because hardly a matter of a dispute, and not denying that fact, it was a little like the added thing about Stuart, about not going on to it too much, but he didn't, as it were, the force wasn't that he told me not to, which of course could simply have sounded cynical or inconsiderate or like... some doubt of, you know, either Les Liaisons Dangereuses or or Marivaux or something. it wasn't that. It was partly because he talked about the person at that time he was disposed to call my predecessor in what could be called an encouraging manner.
Yes. Yeah.
I think. Yeah. So he sort of generated a sensibility about it of a... positive and supportive kind. And one of his great capacities, it seems to me, I mean, you would have thought about all the different ways in which people, as it were, speak well of him, I'm sure, but he seems to me to have a... I hadn't really quite thought of it in these terms. I can't quite put it rightly, Michael, but it's something like this. He has a capacity for generating a way of feeling all right. If he thinks it's all right, I mean, if he thinks you're behaving badly, he'll tell you so, or indicate to you. Even if he doesn't tell you so, he indicates so, perhaps by even a silence. But if he thinks it's all right, really, you haven't done something, you're on the right lines, really, it's had to come out. He has a way of generating confidence or feeling well about it, which isn't at the expense of the other feelings that are appropriate to the occasion, not by denying them. So that, as it were, he can make a positive and, as it were, life-giving emotion, as it were, out of nothing. He can actually increase the emotional economy. That, I mean, a lot of people who say, well, no, you've done the right thing, or you've done the thing that must be right for you and her, or whatever it is, and sort of forget about those other people, or even tries to say those other people haven't got a case, you know, garbage of that kind, which... I mean, unless you are either very cynical or very tough or rather disagreeable, you're not going to believe anyway. He doesn't do that. But he can somehow acknowledge those claims, but generate a surplus out of nothing for one's own claims. And I think that's actually part of the way in which he lives what is, of course, of philosophical importance. I mean, his recognition of coexistent and uncancellable conflicting claims.
Yes.
But it's part of the psychology of that recognition.
Exactly. I mean, I'm digging away, we're both digging away, yeah, at the sense in which he might be considered a wise,
yes,
man and a wise friend.
Yes.
That's why...
I do regard him as a wise man and a wise friend, I must say. Although, I think also there are some things about which he is sometimes quite silly.
He's
perfectly capable of being silly. I think that there are two things about which he's sometimes silly. One of them is a deep matter, and the silliness, though I think it's genuine, is a superficial part of a deeper phenomenon which is not deeply silly. Do you see what I mean? It's better if I don't put it less abstractly. What I have in mind is what he says in the recording you sent to me about the Nazis. That is, I think that it's simply inadequate in a silly way to say that the Nazis were persons whose fundamental values were of a universally accepted kind and which would otherwise be admired, namely patriotism, concern for the decency of their country, the integrity of their national life. Only, unfortunately, they had some erroneous empirical beliefs
about
the Jews. Now, that, in fact, is silly. And it's so silly that obviously we have to ask, as perhaps we will later, some other questions.
Why does a clever man hold a silly view on that?
Why does a clever man who is a Jew hold a silly? Why does a clever man who is a Jew, who is particularly interested in the dark reactionary histories of the European consciousness, say that? And the answer is, must have some more to be said about it. And that's why I say the deeper part of it, though probably in a certain very important way erroneous, is not silly. But what it issued in at that moment, and I've heard similar things occasionally, especially perhaps in his later years, is something which frankly is rather silly. And if an enemy, as it might be Scruton or somebody, saw that, I mean, they would say very unfavourable things about him on the basis of it. I mean, they say this is a foolish, superficial liberal who hasn't understood what's happened to Europe or doesn't understand about human evil or so. I mean, whatever they would say. But I mean, you can imagine a sermon on by George Steiner based on that text, which would be of a very unhelpful character and could do Isaiah, as it were, genuine harm because it would make him look like a silly person that he isn't. There is a dimension of his life in which I simply think is, in a certain way, more deeply silly. That, you know, what I mean by that is it's more silly all through, but also, of course, much less, in a way, important. And it's the dimension of his life which, in a way, I suppose, the focal figure of which is Bowra. That is, that he's always been, as it seems to me, much over-impressed by Bowra. and the world of Bara, and he will tell one stories about Bara endlessly, and in fact tell one the same stories endlessly about Morris. And as we all know, Morris, who I knew a bit, not at all well, certainly not as I didn't, again, I knew him well enough to know what the effect was. And I think I know what he was like, actually. As you well know, did you ever know Bara?
No, but I do.
You know what it's like. You've heard the end of stories. Now, the fact is that Bara did suffer to a considerable extent of being one of these wits whose jokes don't live on the page. I mean, unlike, actually, Wilde. I mean, many wits don't, but unlike Wilde, where these jokes can still be sparkling at you. I mean, you can read them, they can actually make you laugh. Bara wasn't like that. I mean, the thing about his jokes were that they were funny because of the way the remarks were funny, because they simply popped out so unexpectedly. I mean, it was their relation to their context which made them funny.
And therefore you had to be there.
You had to be there, because it was simply a form of social impudence of a certain kind. And without the context and the surprise, it just looks like banal and boorish and superficial and snobbish and boring behaviour.
So the difficulty with Bara, presumably, then, is that there's a kind of systematic overestimation of this character.
Yes.
Well, what I always hear when Isaiah talks about Bara is a very complicated sense that this was a man who valued himself much more highly, for example, as a Greek scholar than he deserved.
That's correct.
All that stuff. Isaiah doesn't seem to me to be deluded about how to evaluate Bara as a person. And therefore, I need to know why you think his...
Yes, well, I think he is.
Engagement with Bara is silly.
Yes. I mean, I don't think his engagement with Bara per se is silly. I think it leads to some... I mean, it's what I call it. It's the focal point of a set of things that I see a certain skewing of the values he would otherwise apply elsewhere in what I would call a Oxford chattery direction. You see, for instance, because, I mean, Isaiah knows perfectly well, and we've had that, he and I have had this conversation more times than I would wish to remember in a way, because especially these days it tends to go on rather predictable lines, like our conversation, incidentally, about what's wrong with Traviata, which is a conversation we must have had almost more times than any... I'll tell you what's wrong with it. Yes, I'll tell you about our conversation about what's wrong with Traviata. Traviata is a very good slip of the tongue.
Perhaps we don't need to have it after all.
No, I'll tell you. I can tell you more precisely what the disagreement is about. It's a perfectly possible disagreement, but it's just... It also illustrates something more interesting, actually, so don't let me forget that.
Let's
finish off Bara. The thing is that Isaiah knows and says perfectly sincerely and correctly that Bara overestimated himself as a scholar. He doesn't locate absolutely precisely the way in which Bara overestimated himself as a scholar, but that doesn't matter much. I mean, the trouble was that Bara himself was impressed by technical scholarship, particularly in the person of Dennis Page, and would then try to write dull scholarly books, which, as well as superficial popular literary books. Now, the superficial popular literary books were superficial and popular, and the dull scholarly books were very bad. Those were articles. I mean, they just weren't very good at it. That was the trouble. He hasn't quite got that, but that was the situation, you see. So Isaiah, it wasn't that Bara resented... It would be false to think that Bara's resentment of what happened to him was simply that... literary works and works with the literary content had been despised by the scholars. He thought his scholarship was despised by the scholars, and well, he was right. But
yeah, right
he was. You see, and Page, the horrible Page, was a much more horrible man than Bara in many ways. He was disgusting, and actually, he had a lot of things wrong with him as a scholar. But he was a much better technical scholar than Bara, and he used to mock him in his lectures. You know, and he'd say, "Well, we've got another verse by the Warden of Wadham here, which isn't Greek," and so on. You know, all this kind of. But the thing is that the point about Isaiah is this: that this envy, and at least this is my view. Isaiah might contradict it, but this is my view. These misestimates. Good enough tape. You're looking at it rather anxiously.
No, just we're going to run out, but that's fine. I can just turn it over.
Okay. I think that this led to a misestimate of two remarkable figures, who were two of the most remarkable classical scholars around here, and happened to be here together, and they were both professors when I was an undergraduate. And I had a very great admiration for both of them in very different ways, namely Frankel and Dodds. Now, Frankel and Dodds were both very remarkable men. Dodds was also a very nice man. Frankel, nobody's ever claimed was a nice man. He was very nice to me, actually. But he was, I had no personal reason, but everybody knew he was a monster. But they were both, in quite different ways, really rather great men. And they were much greater men than Bauer. And the fact is that though Isaiah knows that Bauer overestimated things, he hasn't, as it ever seemed to me, ever been able quite to rewrite that set of evaluations so that people who in a certain sense ought to be respected, namely Dodds for his human qualities as well as his scholarship, Frankel certainly not for his human qualities, but for being a certain kind of quite extraordinary figure in a subject for which Isaiah has a great respect, he hasn't really enough respect for, because that, and that's the sort of thing that he gets from Bauer, and then it turns into exactly the sort of thing that, as it were, continental scholars and others outside Oxford hold against Oxford. I mean, the sort of chattery assessment of manners, or whether somebody has a comical foreign accent, or whether Dodds had communist beliefs, or was interested in spiritualism, or was too wrapped up with Irish poets or something. I mean, just things which you'd have thought in a way were the fabric of an interesting intellectual life. It's really a case that, in that respect, Isaiah's aspects as an intellectual, as, I mean, let's not speak of academic, I mean, as an intellectual, is the point I want to stress, seemed to me a little qualified by the world of the common room, or